Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Joe Blair. He's just published a memoir. It's called By the Iowa Sea. He joins us by telephone from somewhere, I'm guessing, out in eastern Iowa. Is that right?
Iowa City.
Beautiful Iowa City, 52240. Or something like that. Maybe you're in Coralville. Maybe you're not actually.
52240. You got it.
Okay. I used to work at the post office.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. We had to memorize those brutal zip codes. And
They're tough.
Those Johnson County codes were high on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, is this your first book?
Well, first one I got published.
Okay. So how many books has it been before you got this one to fly?
Untold numbers. I don't know. I tried all kinds of books. I tried a lot of fictional books. Some people call them novels.
Mm-hmm.
My books, the problem was that my characters, like my character would always circle the drain, going ever lower and lower, and then I could never figure a way to, like, redeem him. So he'd just stay there. So then my books never had a good ending.
That's an emergency room term. Did you pick that up from your wife? Circling the drain?
Who's a paramedic, yeah.
Yeah. That's an ER term, isn't it?
I don't know. She uses a lot of terms that I can't really tell you right now. But
yeah, I can imagine. Well, I had a friend who was an ER doctor, and he told me, he said, when someone was definitely on their way out, they would say they were circling the drain. So these characters of yours were losers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd call them that. And, you know, it was done. I love graphic novels. I love that sort of that genre, and I kind of wrote them in that vein.
Uh-huh.
Like more the, I guess less graphic novels than underground comics, I'd say, like Harvey Pekar and all those guys that started out to take on issues that are, they're serious issues, but they take them on in a way that serious writers, quote unquote, don't take them on. That's the way I tried to write my novels, and they were failures, so.
Yeah. So you decided to try nonfiction, and it's your story, and this book really reads like a confession.
Well, I'd say, I don't know if I like that word, but maybe it's true. Maybe it's true. I don't know. When I sit down to write, I've been writing essays for a number of years, and by essays, I mean I sit down and write whatever's on my mind, and then I call them essays. Probably every day I try to do it every day for the past 8 years,
uh-huh.
I guess. And really what this book was it was written in present tense as the flood was going on, just day by day. And at that point in my life, you know, I was going through a very tough patch in the marriage. I was going through a lot of soul searching. Some people would call it a midlife crisis. I kind of call it coming of age, I guess. But it was kind of more an act of desperation. And I always found that, I mean, I don't write to try to tell people what they want to hear because it doesn't do me any good. And it's no fun.
Mm-hmm.
I figure you need to tell the truth and all its nastiness and gnarliness and unpleasantries. You have to do it, or else what are you doing? I mean, why write if to try to make myself appear someone who I'm not? It doesn't do me any good. And I think the readers can see right through it when you're not on the level with them. So confession, I guess we'll call it a confession. Yeah,
you'll accept that term?
Sure.
Because this is pretty brutal stuff. I mean, you're married to this wonderful woman, and you just keep doing these really stupid things. At least by reading this book, you really,
hey there,
you
wait
really,
a minute.
You do some really dumb things, Joe.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
I did.
I mean,
I still do.
Yeah, you did everything you could to blow it, and your wife essentially calls you on your stuff, doesn't
mm-hmm.
she?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could see, you know, on the other hand, come on, you know, you reach a point in your life. I reached a point in my life, put it that way. I won't include you. I reached a point in my life where it's like, I'm living with this woman who doesn't really like me, let alone love me. You know, our focus seems is elsewhere. Of course, we have a special needs son, Michael, and we have three other children too. You raise kids, you gotta, you know, put your helmet on and hunker down and do it. You just have to do it. You have to earn the money. You have to raise the kids.
Mm-hmm.
However, you can't ignore the marriage. I don't care how special needs your child is. You can't just let it go, because that's what produced the kid in the first place. You know, the love between two people. And I was at the point where our marriage was basically non-existent, and I wasn't going to accept it. So what do? I become an idiot and create a bunch of drama so that I have an excuse to leave, I guess. I mean, in retrospect, that's probably what I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, and it was a coward's way out, but that's the way. I didn't think I had any choice in the matter. I thought, look, I've come to this point in my life, don't like the job, marriage sucks, you know. I'm in this place, I can't get out. There's no escape. But what I learned, I think, mainly through writing the book, living through it, but writing the book day by day, you know, you examine yourself and you examine the reason you're doing what you're doing. And I kind of discovered that a lot of these people in this book believe with all their heart that they have no choice. They're employed in this profession. They need to continue on. They're in this marriage. They need to continue on. They're in this position, and that's the way it will always be. But when the flood came, and we saw these houses completely destroyed, these houses that were fully paid for, some of them out of the floodplain, 500-year floodplain, not insured, destroyed. Everybody who lived these lives, that perfect lives, paid their mortgages on time, you know, did everything they should do, everything changed. And I kind of realized that whether I think so or not, things will change. And I'd better make some choices in my own life, or they're going to change in ways that I have no control over at all. You know, so really, ultimately, I think it's a book about freedom. And by freedom, I mean choice, that I found choice. And what I chose was my wife and my family in the end.
Joe Blair joins us. His book is By the Iowa Sea, and he's mentioned the flooding and the water a couple times. Some of our listeners are probably not aware of what you're referring to.
Well, 2008, the Iowa River flooded, and so did the Cedar River. Lots of parts of Iowa flooded in 2008 in spring. Cedar Rapids, about 1,000 city blocks were underwater. One part of the city we had, I think it was 14 feet of water in this one neighborhood in Cedar Rapids. And you could go around after the flood and see the high water marks. It's just unbelievable.
Mm.
You know, unbelievable. And Iowa City, of course, was affected too. The neighborhood where we had raised our kids went under, and we were involved in building a levee down there in that neighborhood, which didn't do any good. But, and we had moved out of that house about a year earlier. But, of course, you know, we knew and loved all the people down that neighborhood. They all lost their homes.
So, your son, Mike, how old is he now?
He's 14 now.
How's he doing?
Mike is severely autistic. He doesn't have much language. He is going through puberty, which makes him a little more aggressive. Sometimes you tell him he's got to go to bed and he attacks you. I'm a little bigger than he is still. But he's bigger than his mom. He's got to be 5'9 now. So he'll like start running toward me and sort of change his mind and attack his mom, which isn't cool. It's kind of, you know, we laugh about it, Deb and I, but, you know, if he gets much bigger, it's not going to be funny.
Yeah.
You know? So he's, you know, we haven't given up on Mike. You know, we try different things all the time. You know, that part of the reason we ended up moving to Massachusetts is for the ocean, because when we were on a trip in San Francisco, family vacation, once he got to the ocean, he quieted down. He was happy. He just loves the ocean. And we thought, if we get Mike to the ocean, he'll be better. Of course, that's not the case. That's wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. He was better a little bit. I mean, he loves the ocean. But we haven't been able to fix him.
At the end of the book, you move back to Massachusetts, and you're in Iowa at this very moment. Are you back in Iowa then?
Yeah, we moved back. We spent a year in Massachusetts. It was a wonderful year. And, you know, when we moved out there, we had no reason. It was, I had been wanting to move to Massachusetts. That's where I grew up, in the Boston area, actually right outside of Lowell, Mass. I had grown up there, and I had wanted to move back. We had been in Iowa for 16 years at that point, and it had been a kind of a bone of contention between my wife and me. And I would say, come with me. Come away with me. I wanted us to go together and do something crazy. Mm. And she said, no. Why? Don't you respect this family? How about Mike? How about the kids? How about school? How about your job? How about all these things? And I'm like, well, screw all that stuff. Let's go. Let's just go. And she said, no. So in a way, it was like, you know, just at the very core of our problems, she saw me as wanting to run away, and I saw her as not wanting to come with me. So in the end, when I finally say, you know, Iowa is beautiful. You know, this family is beautiful. What we've been blessed with these things here, with this house and this family, this wife. Let's stay here. And at that very moment, Deb says, let's go. So we went, and it was great. But, you know, it was hard to explain to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to Massachusetts. Oh, what? Did you get a job out there? No. Well, why are you going? Because we feel like it, which doesn't really fly.
Yeah.
It kind of pisses people off in a way. But we went anyway.
Well, I'm guessing after being there for a year, looking back at Iowa City and your home and your people back there, suddenly you kind of felt the draw to go back. And you had a client base there. I'm guessing you're still doing your day job. Do you want to talk about your day job? I think it's a pretty cool thing to talk about.
Well, actually, I had my own business for a number of years. I did heating and air conditioning, commercial, industrial mainly. And we owned a good-sized house and had a couple cars, and we had a lot of expenses. And another job came up that I had always wanted. I've always wanted to be a chiller mechanic, primarily, just solely a chiller mechanic. Chillers are big pieces of equipment that, for lack of, I'll say, make cold water, even though that's not really what they do. They produce cold water, which is pumped through a building for air conditioning or process cooling. So, and to me, I just love the idea of working on this big equipment. I just wanted to do it. For one thing, it's inside in the winter times, and I hate being on rooftops in the winter times. So, I wanted this job, and I got an offer at Train in Des Moines, and I couldn't afford to take the job. I had to tell Steve, my boss now, that I can't afford it, which is absurd.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, and now we've kind of come to our senses. We've bought a small ranch after we moved back, a small ranch that we can afford the payments on, and I've taken this job that I've always wanted, and I love it. And so I'm a mechanic. I do you could call it a pipe fitter. Refrigeration mechanic, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do. I fix equipment. And believe me, after writing the book and actually getting it published, and actually some people out there, one or two in the world, are actually reading it,
mm-hmm.
it is kind of a frightening thing. You're really exposed as an author. It's just, I thank God every time I get in that van and head to whatever mechanical room I'm going to work in that day, because, you know, it's something I can do.
Uh-huh.
It's something I can do, and when I'm done, it's either fixed or not fixed, and I know it. And when you write, I put this stuff out there. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. Did I do it? Did I not do it? No idea. No clue. So it's nice to have something certain in my life that I can actually get paid for. It's great.
That's your comfort zone.
Oh, yeah.
At one point in the book, you're talking about the aftermath of that flood, and there's a restaurant in an old power station there in Coralville that was right by the river that got extensively damaged, and you're describing how you're in there and you're trying to thaw this block of ice, and you do something incredibly stupid, I'm guessing, and it sounds like you just about electrocuted yourself. We don't really get the details on what happened after that, but we get up to the point where this bad thing happens. And to me, that was a metaphor for what you did with your marriage. You had to do something stupid and kind of shock yourself into going back to reality.
Well, I'm glad that you see it that way. And it's really nice that it works that way. But the truth is, it's just something that happened.
Uh-huh.
I almost killed myself. I set up an industrial heater. It's kind of like a hair dryer.
Mm-hmm.
To try to melt this ice, and it fell into a pool of water where I was working and zapped me pretty good, blew a breaker.
Mm.
But I kind of blacked out, and I think I'm a little bit lucky that I'm talking to you on the phone right now. But yeah, it's like, but this whole book, originally it was filled with death, because, you know, let's face it, that's the next miracle for all of us, right? We live through the birth, we were born, that's the first one. The second big one is going to be there, and it goes right with the flood, because it's a change. It's a change from one thing to the next. And my editor was like freaked out by all this death stuff. She's a young woman.
Uh-huh.
She's hopeful. God bless her.
Yeah.
She's a great editor. She's still hopeful, poor thing. And she hated all this death stuff. So she said, "You've got to get rid of that crap. I don't want to read about it, and no one else does either." So I'm like, "All right.
Uh-huh.
Can I have one death thing?" And that was it.
So it was your near death
that
made the cut.
That's right. I made the cut.
Okay. Because I was going to say, I don't remember all these people dying in this book.
No, no one died. Nobody was always like, I was always like obsessed with the idea of it, you know. And who wants to really read about that? But I couldn't help it, you know. I was just writing whatever I felt like.
So how long was it before the editor got a hold of it?
Well, I figured I'd never get really published, and it's a hard thing to do. I did go through the nonfiction program at Iowa, but that doesn't matter. You know, you send stuff out, they reject you just as happily with that degree as without it. They don't care if you have a degree.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, I'm screwed. I'm never going to get published. And then a friend of mine, the New York Times called him during the flood and asked if he would write like a letter from the floodplain. And he's a well-known writer, and he said, "No, I'm not even in Iowa. I can't really write that, but I know a guy who maybe could do it." So I get this call out of the blue from the New York Times, and they said, "Hey, we're the Times, and would you be interested in writing an article?" I'm like, "Let me think about that." "Yes." And they say, they're like, "Well, we need it by tomorrow morning." So I'm like, "Oh my God." I'm like, "Yeah, no problem." So
that sounds like Chris Offutt.
Oh, is that what happened with Chris?
No, was he the one that put the Times on to you?
No,
oh,
he wasn't.
Because I know he was up in Iowa City for
a while.
He's
a good man. He's a good man, and he might have had if they had asked him. But
oh, okay.
Since I told you I wrote every day, so for me it was kind of routine to sit down and write whatever I felt like.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it the next morning. I went in. I couldn't write it that night. for some reason, and I went to bed. I'm like, I'm screwed. This is the difference between writers and not writers. Writers can write, and I can't write this thing. But I went in the next morning when it was due, and I just wrote it. I'm like, hey, this works, and I sent it, and that was it. That was published, and then I got something else in the Times and Modern Love, and then suddenly I have some agents that want to talk to me, which is beyond my wildest dreams. Agents want to talk to me.
Wow.
So I flew in and talked to these agents, and luckily got one. And she said, "Okay, what do you got?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, I got a bunch of novels where the guy circles the drain." He says, "No, I don't want that." And I go, "And I got about 1,000 essays. Look, I got 1,000 essays." She's like, "Yeah, but what do you got?" I'm like, 1,000 essays." She didn't want essays. She wants a book. She's like, "I can't sell these."
Mm-hmm.
So I had to take all these crazy essays that were in every which way. You know, we think our lives have an arc, but they don't. They're like a freaking goat path. They're all over the place. So I had to somehow like take all these essays and make an arc out of them.
Mm-hmm.
No pun, Noah intended.
Right.
But I had to do it, and it took me about 2 years to do it. And then my editor Janice Dono, she sent it out. It got roundly rejected. Then I worked on it all the time in New England when we were living in Massachusetts, and we sent it out again, and we had a few publishing houses that bid on it, and that was it.
That's a very cool story. You want to talk about the bottle of wine? What's her name?
I don't really
okay.
want to, but I can
talk. I'm guessing about that was not her real name in the book.
Yeah, that was not her real name.
Is she
do that.
Is she a known writer?
To her. Well, some people know her.
Like you?
I know her.
Okay.
Yeah.
This was the
other... She wishes that I didn't know her now, but I did.
This is the other woman, the one that almost broke up your marriage.
Yes. Well, she didn't almost break.
No,
she was
but,
innocent. That was me.
Yeah.
You know, I did it.
I love these writing exercises that you would do. You'd go down to the coffee shop and you'd do these exercises. I thought those were pretty cool. I enjoyed those.
That's how I write.
Okay.
Yeah, I have this long-term writing partner, Lauren Reese, and you sit face to face with your laptops. You open your laptops and you just start to write, can't stop, and you keep going for sometimes an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, whatever, until you're done. And then when you're both done, you just read aloud whatever it is you've written to each other, and that's it. You close your laptops. That's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I'll do usually is I'll go back the next day, I'll edit whatever it is I wrote. Sometimes it'll be like a two-session essay. So you can write anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 words right in an hour. So sometimes it'll take me two sessions and you end up with a longer essay. But that's how we've been writing for years. And that's I've kind of become dependent upon it.
And you can sit in a noisy coffee shop and do that?
Yes.
That's
yeah.
What,
oh, yeah. It's like sleeping, kind of, because you start, and then you're done. You're like, holy crap, that was an hour,
mm-hmm.
And then you look down and look. I have two pages, single space. That's pretty good, and that's what we do.
My guest is Joe Blair. His memoir is By the Iowa Sea. It was recently published by Scribner, and he joins us by telephone today from Iowa City, Iowa. You got some. Pretty decent plugs on this book. You've obviously made some good friends. I mentioned Chris Offutt before. He gave you a great plug. We've had him on the show. Anthony Doerr gave you a nice one. We've had him on the show. I looked at your Facebook page last night. I see you're friends with one of my favorite writers, Donald Ray Pollock.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
He is. And he's just down the road from us here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love his work.
I do, too. I was going to guess that when you were talking about the kind of novels and stories you like to read, that he was probably on the list.
Yeah, I find, you know, he's an amazing writer. But I read his first book, Knock 'Em Stiff, second.
Uh-huh.
I read his second book first, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And I kind of felt transformed at the end, but kind of transformed in like a bummed out way. I'm like, oh my God, I'm depressed. Is this the way people really are?
Uh-huh.
But I'm like, it was so good. I had to read his first book, and then I was thoroughly depressed after that book, blown away by the writing. But you got to like take a breath every now and then to come up from that. You know, that's tough, man. That's brutal writing right there.
Yeah. Well, he's about the most modest guy you could know.
I heard him on the radio.
He's just an amazing guy. So what happens next, Joe? Are you going to just keep doing your day job and hang out and see how this book does? Are you doing some book signings? What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing a radio interview. This is like my third interview ever, but it's kind of weird, but it's kind of fun. It's like going to the psychiatrist's office or something. Talk about yourself for a little while. And I'm doing some readings, and I was on TV one time. That was nerve-wracking.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm just doing whatever they tell me. Whatever my publicist tells me to do, I do. I figure I owe them that. They gave me an advance. So, and besides, it's kind of fun. It's like, for me, it's like outside my comfort zone. But to be honest, I mean, I'm almost, Deb and I, my wife and I, talk about like what kind of life we want to live and what we want to do. It's kind of messed up, but I'm doing it. I'm actually doing it. You know, I love my job. I love to write. I'm still writing every day, still going to my job every day. I love my family. It's like I'm happy. It's hard to believe. I'm so happy now.
Well, that is something, and I really enjoyed the book. I think that you did a great job writing it, and I think your editor did a wonderful job editing it, and it really worked for me. And the passages, and there are a number of them, about your relationship with Mike, your son with the special needs, mm-hmm. and your relationship with your wife, and all the turmoil and how you deal with it, and the way that you work through things is very compelling.
Well, thank you.
So you got another fan.
All right.
That's me.
All right.
And it's a great cover, too. It's a great title.
Isn't that a beautiful picture?
It is. It looks like Grant Wood or something.
That I think I even saw that cloud. I might be crazy, but it looked like a big spaceship hovering over. It must probably be a different one. It's probably not even Iowa. I don't know, but
uh-huh.
It's a cool-looking cover. The title, I wish I could say I love it. I couldn't. It took me like 2 years to come up with a title. And I came up with hundreds of titles, and I hated every one of them. But and this was just one more that I hated, but they said, hey, man, enough. This is the one we're using.
Okay.
And that's what I needed. I needed someone to, like, spank me. Someone to say, no more. This is the title. I said, okay.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate your time today, Joe.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My guest has been Joe Blair, his memoir, By the Iowa Sea. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Tune in next week when my guest will be Dayton's own Laura McManus. She's the oldest cheerleader in the National Football League. Her memoir is It's Not About the Pom-Poms. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.